Thank you for coming out on this nice, very early spring evening. My name is Bob Clark, and I am the supervisory archivist here at the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. And on behalf of the National Archives and the National Park Service, welcome to the Henry A. Wallace Visitor Center. Before we get started, let me just go through a couple of housekeeping matters. The first thing is, if anybody has one of these, would you please take it out and turn it off or turn it on vibrate so that our speaker isn't interrupted tonight? I'd also like to thank the library's public affairs specialist, Clifford Lobby, for doing his usual great job in organizing the program and getting the word out so that you could all come and join us tonight. So thank you, Cliff. The format of our program is that our speaker will speak for 30, 40 minutes or so, and then he'll be happy to take some questions. And then after the question and answer period, he will go out to the table next to the New Deal Museum store, where he'll be happy to sign the books that I know that you're all going to want to rush out and buy after you hear Harvey speak. So let me introduce our speaker. Harvey J. Kay is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay. An award-winning author, Kay has published 15 books on history, politics, ideas, and contributed articles and essays to a diverse array of publications. He's also appeared as a guest on numerous television and radio programs, and most recently he appeared on our own KIP, right? Yesterday morning. So we're glad to have him here. Harvey was born in New Jersey. He received his BA at Rutgers, his MA from the University of London, and his PhD at Louisiana State University. And he is a member of the National Writers Union, the AFT, and the PEN, and an Organization of American Historians Distinguished Lecturer. He lives in Green Bay with his wife, Lorna, who I've had the pleasure of spending the evening with. And they've raised two daughters, and they root for the Packers, but we'll forgive him for that. I actually first got to know Harvey a few years ago when he and I served on the advisory committee of historians for the Franklin D. Roosevelt Four Freedoms Park, which is down on Roosevelt Island in New York City. And if you haven't had a chance yet to go to Roosevelt Four Freedoms Park, I really encourage you to do so. Not only is the park and the monument itself really extraordinary, but the views of the east side of Manhattan are just not to be believed. So before I turn it over to Harvey, I just want to read to you a quote from Arthur Schlesinger Jr., one of the great Roosevelt scholars for whom our research room here is named. And he says, "The duty of an American historian is to tell the truth about the past as best he can and let the chips fall where they may." That perfectly embodies what you're about to hear from Harvey Kay. He tells the truth and lets the chips fall where they may. So, ladies and gentlemen, my friend Harvey Kay.
This is very exciting. Yesterday, I gave my first talk as part of the release of my book at the National Archives. And I was just ecstatic at the thought that I was standing, giving a lecture not far from the National Mall, which to me is one of the finest spaces in the world. I love the monuments. And also that I was standing beneath the documents that I take so seriously. So I was thrilled. But I'm thrilled to be here in a similar fashion. And I first, in that vein, I want to thank the library staff for inviting me, especially Bob Clark, who I think of as my friend, and Cliff Lobby, who I hope will be my friend hereafter, unless I embarrass him this evening. The reason that I'm so thrilled to be here is not just because I spend time working in the archives here. No FDR historian could ever fail to come here. But it's also that I'll never forget the first morning I was working here, and when I was holding the papers that went into the writing of the Four Freedoms speech, I kept thinking in a fantasy-like way that maybe, just maybe, I'm touching Franklin Roosevelt's DNA. And I walked out onto the lawn. I was heading off to go across the street to a pub that was over there. I assume it's still there. And I called my wife and I said, "I know I have to eat lunch, but I don't want to wash my hands." When I told Bob that story, he said, "As long as you washed your hands after you had dinner, before you came back into the library to touch any of those documents." So I guess we were okay there. Anyhow, it was very exciting, and I love this space. This to me is truly the finest presidential library and home. I mean, I've been to a few, and this one actually still feels like a home to come to. The other thing I want to say, and Bob hinted at that in his opening remarks, is that I wrote The Fight for the Four Freedoms not simply as a historian, but also as an advocate, an historical and, I confess, a political advocate. You know, there are those who think that we make too much of those men and women we have come to call the greatest generation and its greatest leader. I think we make too little of them. In short, because I have to the talk to explain myself, I think we are failing to remember, as the subtitle of my book says, what made FDR and the Greatest Generation truly great. And in failing to remember that, we're not just failing them, we're failing ourselves. And that's the argument that I want to offer now. We need to remember what conservatives have never wanted us to remember, and what liberals have all too often forgotten. We need to remember what we have been trying so hard to remember. Now especially, after more than 30 years of subordinating the public good to corporate priorities and private greed, of subjecting ourselves to widening inequalities and intensifying insecurities, of allowing our rights to be threatened. Indeed, of denying our own democratic impulses and yearnings, we need to remember who we are. We need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who rescued the United States from economic destruction in the Great Depression and defended it against fascism and imperialism in the Second World War. We need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who not only saved the nation from economic ruin and political oblivion, but also turned it into the strongest and most prosperous country on earth. And most of all, we need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who accomplished all of that in the face of fierce opposition and despite their own faults and failings. By harnessing the powers of democratic government and making America freer, more equal, and more democratic than ever before. Now, when so much of what they fought for is under siege, and we find ourselves confronting crises that threaten the nation and all that it stands for, we need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the most progressive generation in American history. We are the children of the men and women who articulated, fought for, and endowed us with the promise of the Four Freedoms. On the afternoon of January 6, 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt went up to Capitol Hill to deliver his annual message to Congress. Just weeks earlier, he had defeated Republican Wendell Willkie at the polls and won re-election to an unprecedented third term. But he now faced a far bigger challenge, one even more daunting than those he confronted in his first two terms. Still stalked by the Depression, the United States was also increasingly threatened by the Axis powers, Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, Imperial Japan. And with war already raging east and west, Americans had yet to agree about how to respond to that danger. The president, however, did not falter. He not only proceeded to propose measures to address the emergency, he also gave dramatic new meaning to all men are created equal, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We, the people of the United States, a new birth of freedom and government of the people, by the people, for the people. Roosevelt knew about crises, but he knew as well what Americans could accomplish, even in the darkest of times. In some ways, some of the things I'm saying tonight seem evident to people who live here in the Hudson Valley and probably know Roosevelt more intimately than even many a scholar knows him. Born in 1882, Roosevelt had grown up privileged, the son of Hudson River gentry. Yet long before becoming president, he had suffered a series of defeats and setbacks. None more devastating than contracting polio in 1921 at the age of 39. The disease had left him permanently unable to stand up or walk without assistance. However, supported by his wife Eleanor and host of family, friends, and others, he had risen above the paralysis to become the most dynamic political figure in the United States. Moreover, his experiences in the course of doing so had reaffirmed and deepened his already powerful faith and confidence in God, in himself, and most especially, perhaps, in his fellow citizens. All of which had enabled him, in the face of the worst economic and social catastrophe in the nation's history, to say, quote, "There is no question in my mind that it is time for the country to become fairly radical for a generation." I have to tell you, I was interviewed today by Bill Moyers. It'll broadcast this weekend. And I mentioned this line of FDR's, and I left out the fairly. I said, radical for a generation. And Bill looked at me and said, fairly radical for a generation. Fairly radical. Well, anyhow, this was this confidence that I'm referring to that enabled him to declare, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." To insist that democracy is not a static thing, it is an everlasting march. And to proudly proclaim, "This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny." Propelled by the popular energies that his words and actions elicited, he determinedly launched initiatives of relief, recovery, reconstruction, and reform known as the New Deal. And if you don't know it, the one of those four that he had the least desire to pursue was actually relief. He believed in creating jobs. Together, president and people severely tested each other, made real mistakes and regrettable compromises, and suffered serious defeats and disappointments. Nevertheless, challenging and pushing each other to live up to their finest ideals and aspirations, FDR and his fellow citizens advanced them further than either had ever expected or imagined possible. Even as they confronted and dealt with harsh and concerted attacks from their powerful antagonists, very conservative Democrats and Republicans, and corporate leaders who wanted not to have to pay their taxes, they not only rejected the sirens of authoritarianism, they also redeemed the nation's historic purpose and promise by initiating revolutionary changes in government and public life and radically extending American freedom, equality, and democracy. By way of a great host of alphabet soup agencies and associations, from the SEC, the CCC, and the WPA, to the CIO, the AYC, and the NAACP, they subjected big business and banking to public account and regulation. They empowered the federal government to address the needs of working people and the poor and established a social security system. They organized labor unions, consumer campaigns, and civil rights organizations. They fought for the rights and broadened the we in We the People. The one thing that's often left out of the story of Roosevelt and the New Deal is just how much they really did transform the meaning of the we in We the People. Okay, the fact that Catholics and Jews became central to the creation of the New Deal, and in essence, no longer would the United States be merely a nation dominated by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So they fought for their rights and broadened the we in We the People. They built schools, libraries, parks, and playgrounds. They expanded the nation's public infrastructure, and they improved the American environment. They cultivated the arts and refashioned popular culture, best exemplified in swing music and dance. And though there was still much to be done, they imbued themselves with fresh democratic convictions, hopes, and aspirations. Standing before the American people and their assembled representatives that early January day in 1941, Roosevelt surely believed their rendezvous with destiny had come. Speaking without hesitation, he proceeded to expound upon the profound crisis and the mortal dangers facing the United States, and to explain how the nation could not just confront them, but actually prevail in doing so. I will tell you that I believe the real call to arms is the Four Freedoms speech, not the Pearl Harbor speech of the infamy day. I believe it's this speech. Rejecting isolationist arguments that Americans should simply hunker down behind great defensive walls, Roosevelt rallied his fellow citizens around a dynamic image of America serving as the great arsenal of democracy. And dismissing those who said that the crisis required Americans to give up their hard-fought advances, he argued that an effective mobilization required them to not simply sustain their democratic achievements, but also extend and deepen them. Finally, articulating America's grandest ideals and aspirations and strivings anew, the president defined a cause and a generation. In the future days, which we seek to make secure, he said, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. The third is freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear. Isolationists denounce the president's call to turn the United States into the arsenal of democracy. And many a conservative, Northern Republicans, Southern Democrats, rejected his expansive democratic vision. But most Americans responded otherwise. While they may not have been able to recite those freedoms exactly, they backed the call to action, affirmed the promise pronounced, and in the wake of Japan's December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, made those four freedoms the nation's war aims. In the name of those four freedoms, 16 million Americans. You know, we live in an age of billions and trillions. Think about it this way. 16 million Americans. That's one out of every eight Americans served during that time. 350,000 of them were women. Americans of every faith, class, and color put on uniforms and pursued a global struggle that we would come to call the Good War. Not for the character of the combat, but for the rightness of the cause and the unity of purpose in which the nation pursued it. With their allies, they would storm beaches, slog through jungles, tramp across icy fields, sail through submarine-infested waters, fly missions over heavily fortified territories, and punch, push, claw, and ultimately power their way to victory. And contrary, and this is my fellow historians have done a real disservice to the soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen of those days. Contrary to most historians' assertions, those men and women, those men overwhelmingly so, fought not just for their buddies, not just for their buddies, though for that alone they should be thanked. They also fought, as their own letters, reports, and memoirs attest, for the promise of the four freedoms. In late 1944, Harper's editor, Frederick Lewis Allen, would write that Americans had become not simply a united people, but also one possessed of a faith which, with the aid of bulldozers, was able to move mountains. And surely the greatest testament to that faith is that those who most suffered the nation's injustices, America's racial and religious minorities, went all out as much as their fellow citizens, if not even more so. Determined to secure America's promise against both America's foreign enemies and its own racists and reactionaries, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, and Jewish Americans served in greater numbers proportionally than almost any other group. And though African American numbers were limited by official quota, 10%, and they were assigned to segregated units, 1 million of them served. Even 22,500 Japanese Americans served, despite the fact that many of their own families were interned in camps. My best friend in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Japanese American, was born in one of those camps while his father was serving in military intelligence. But what's really fascinating, and I think for too many years, I'm going to sidebar this if you don't mind, I think for too many years we've only looked to derogate, to deny, to denigrate American history. And what we failed to do is to acknowledge the tragedies and the ironies, but also recognize the degree to which people of color, minorities, would not allow that racism to define who they were, because they would not allow those folks to even begin to assume they would be left out of the promise of the four freedoms. I mean, I think it's absolutely crucial that when we teach American history, and that's what I do in many of my classes, that it's important not to simply criticize and criticize and criticize, which I think my generation has done a damn good job of doing. I think it's a matter of not overlooking the failings, the sins, and all of that, but not to forget that in spite of that, we've made history over and over again, and more often, thank goodness, for the better. In any case, at the same time that 16 million went into uniform, Americans at home not only prayed for the safe and sound return of their loved ones, they also went all out, both as workers and as volunteers, to provide the arms and materiel required for total victory. to maintain the morale and material well-being of GIs and civilians alike, and to protect and improve what those servicemen and women were defending. Once again, president and people were to test each other, make tragic mistakes and sorry compromises. The internment of the Japanese Americans from the West Coast to the interior, the segregation of African Americans, the failure to do more to enable refugees, overwhelmingly Jewish, to come into this country before the war began. Nonetheless, they not only prevailed over their enemies, they also once again compelled each other to actually enhance American democratic life in the process. We think that crisis means we stop everything else, that we don't continue to act like Americans. And what we fail to know is that the greatest generations, founders, those who defended the Union under Lincoln, and this generation, what they realized is what we forget, and I'll come back to this. This is the whole point of my talk, but the point of my book. The only way to defend, sustain, and secure American democratic life is to enhance it. When we stop doing that, then our grand experiment comes to an end. Now, predictably, the political right, again, Southern Democrats, too many a Northern Republican, and the conservative rich of the day continue to oppose Democratic initiatives. Congressional Republicans and Southern Democrats join together not only to limit the power of labor, but also to block or weaken bills enabling overseas GIs to vote. The Republicans feared that most GIs would vote for FDR, and when the time came, most did. The Southern Democrats feared that black GIs would get to vote and like it, and there'd be no going back. Concurrently, business executives, anxious about Americans' democratic impulses, but knowing they could not openly oppose the four freedoms, harnessed them to corporate advertising and promotions, even as they themselves denied the promise of those freedoms, and fervently tried to rewrite those freedoms to include a fifth freedom, which you'll hear echoed a little later, freedom of private enterprise. Of course, the right and conservative rich had good reason to worry. Americans were vigorously expanding the labor, once again, the labor, consumer, and civil rights movements. In 1941, there were 50,000 members of the NAACP. In 1945, there were 450,000 members of the NAACP. Even in the midst of war, Americans continued to act. Hell, they became all the more intensively American. So, they expand these movements. They subject industry and the marketplace to even greater public control. They reduce inequality and poverty. And though deadly race riots broke out both North and South, Americans were also further transforming the we in We the People. We all know the story of the bomber crews with names from all across Europe, but they're Americans. My father's tank crew, German Americans, my father Jewish American, the Italian Americans. I mean, that's what that war did. Undeniably, segregated military for African Americans. But they too would not be denied their role as Americans. Moreover, the overwhelming majority of Americans endorsed the idea of pursuing new progressive initiatives at war's end. I can give you the figures, but quickly I'll tell you that 85% of Americans wanted an economic bill of rights, not just a GI bill of rights. And that led Roosevelt in January 1944, to give a new annual address to Congress in which he called for the enactment, or at least the pursuit, of that second Bill of Rights, or economic Bill of Rights. FDR passed away in April 1945. Germany and Japan surrendered in the months that followed. But the promise of the four freedoms did not expire. Even as the United States began to take off in an unprecedented economic expansion and to enter into a Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union, most Americans, bolstered by the public investments of the New Deal, by the investments of the war effort and the truly phenomenal investments of the GI Bill, let's not forget, 12 million veterans of World War II enjoyed, took advantage, rightly so, of educational and housing benefits at that time. One of the greatest excuse my putting in these terms, public welfare program in American history. And doing so, they transformed themselves and the nation for the better. Not all Americans wanted the changes that the Four Freedoms promised. Not everyone wanted to enhance American democratic life. Reactionaries down south, conservatives in all the parties, and a host of corporate bosses had their own ambitions for post-war America. Determined as ever to reverse the progressive accomplishments of the Roosevelt years, cancel out the promise of the Four Freedoms, and bury the idea of an economic bill of rights, they set themselves anew to containing or suppressing, if not extinguishing, Americans' democratic aspirations and energies. And harnessing the Cold War, House Un-American Activities Committee, and McCarthyism, from my state of Wisconsin, to their causes, they enjoyed successes. By the early 1950s, they had tamed liberals, marginalized radicals, and stymied the campaigns of labor and civil rights movements, not to mention effectively effacing FDR's Four Freedoms from public debate. Adlai Stevenson, the so-called liberal, in 1952 campaign, did not talk of the Four Freedoms, and then had the audacity, after Eisenhower was elected, to say to the Democratic Party gathering in, it would have been one of the Jefferson-Jackson Day dinners, he said, "Where are the Four Freedoms today?" And he never even mentioned it during the campaign. So things were tightening, okay? And yet for all of the efforts to erase the Four Freedoms from our memories, they could not get Americans to forget their hard-won victories or the promise that encouraged them. In fact, as Americans continued to make the nation ever stronger and richer, they also pressed freedom, equality, and democracy forward. You know, here again, the teaching of history, we often think, well, we had all these changes in the 30s and into the 40s. The 50s is like, it's as if nothing happened in the 1950s, other than more houses, more cars, and television. But even in the 50s, Americans were pressing forward, never as quickly, never as directly, never as completely as some wished and hoped and pushed for, but always forward they went. The generation that beat the Great Depression by taking up the labors of the New Deal and then defeated fascism and imperialism by going all out became a decidedly civic generation, as Robert Putnam, the political scientist, once put it. They built new communities, churches, schools, and civic associations. They secured higher living standards for themselves and their families. Under Eisenhower, they expanded Social Security to include those who had to be left out in the 1930s to get it through a Congress dominated by Southern Democrats. They even began to enact laws banning racial and religious discrimination, not to mention the famous Brown v. Board decision in 54 that declares segregated public schools unconstitutional. And though it will take time to unfold, we know the Southerners themselves knew, even the harshest white supremacists knew, their time was coming to an end. And when Americans, when that generation was seriously challenged in the 1960s to live up to the promise that so many of them had struggled to articulate and advance, they recommitted the nation to doing so. The power of Roosevelt's Four Freedoms endured. Those who marched for civil rights, campaigned to end poverty, organized public employee unions, pushed to enact health care for the elderly and poor, demanded equal rights for women, reformed the nation's immigration law, expanded public education in the arts, pressed. Is this for me, by the way? Pressed for greater regulation of business and industry to protect the environment, workers, and consumers. Did not regularly recite those freedoms, but many did. Moreover, they were not only inspired and informed by the struggles and achievements of the president and people who first proclaimed and fought for those freedoms, they were called to act anew by men and women of that generation. Labor leaders like the black civil rights and labor leader A. Philip Randolph, Walter Reuther, Cesar Chavez, Jerry Wirth, civil rights activists such as Ella Baker and James Farmer, and even Martin Luther King, who was already this young, precocious guy, was in college during World War II and heard about the Four Freedoms from his father, Martin Luther King Sr., From Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College down in Atlanta, and from A. Philip Randolph, who occasionally came to the college and spoke of the Four Freedoms fervently. Environmentalists like Rachel Carson and Barry Commoner, and feminists such as Esther Peterson, not so well known, but in the Kennedy administration, and Betty Friedan. Esther Peterson was the pioneer of the first Equal Pay Act in 1963, I think he signed it, or 62, Kennedy. In fact, from the Kennedy and Johnson White Houses to the House and Senate, those who actually proposed and enacted the laws and initiatives that made the decade so progressive were themselves most often veterans of the democratic struggles of the 30s and 40s. I'm leaving out the full roster. You know, that was the hardest section to write of this book, actually. You know, I was born in 1949. I was a child of the 60s, you might say. And, you know, I think my generation, both those who went off to fight and those of us who stayed behind, we all think that we made that decade. That 60s is our decade. What we forget is that it's our parents who are still making the laws, who are still even, they were the ones still calling for the changes. Fascinating discovery on my part to realize just how much my parents' generation had actually accomplished. You know, there was a letter recently in the New York Times, I want to quote you this letter. It was by a wounded World War II veteran, still alive, I suppose, he's about 90 years of age, named Edward Wood Jr. Has he ever spoken here, Edward Wood? He's also written some history, sort of memoirs of World War II. I don't know if you all know, but there's a big discussion as to Lyndon Johnson be viewed by history now that we're moving decades away from his time. And there was a discussion of this and a debate that's already underway. And in the New York Times, a story was covered. And Edward Wood wrote this letter to the Times, quote, "For my generation of World War II veterans, the social legislation passed under Lyndon Johnson's leadership helped fulfill some of the ideals we had fought for in that war, expressed in 1941 by President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Four Freedoms." Wood says, "I cried from a long-delayed joy when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. Johnson's other legislation still resonates 50 years later." Presumably he was referring to Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, and other things. "Johnson's initiatives helped create the society we fought for from 1941 to 45. Now, undeniably, the age of Roosevelt and the progressive pursuit of the Four Freedoms can seem a very long time ago. But even now, after so many years of conservative politics and concerted class war from above," I'm laughing to myself as I say this. I had a wonderful time on Friday morning with Tom Sipos on the radio. And I have to tell you, that you'll enjoy hearing this, perhaps. I thought, I've done conservative talk radio before. I can do this. You know, I mean, I always have a good time. Nobody raises the flag above the flag I'll raise. So I had a backup plan. If you called me a commie, I was going to call you a fascist. Okay? Didn't come to that. We had a great time. And as I'm telling you these stories now, I'm thinking, have I lost my new friend in conversation? I continue. So anyhow, the age of Roosevelt and the progressive pursuit of the Four Freedoms can seem a very long time ago. But even now, after so many years of what we've seen from the late 70s to the present day, and let me make it clear, it didn't begin with Ronald Reagan, it began with Jimmy Carter, okay, this move to the right. Carter did all of the things that Reagan pursued. The deregulation of industry and banking. He refused to support labor law reform. He turned his back on Ralph Nader's consumer rights movement. That's where it begins. Reagan was in some ways less innovative for conservatives than Jimmy Carter, though they would never say that. Okay, they would never say that. The progressive legacy of that generation continues to nourish us. Pick any area of American life. From Social Security to the parks we enjoy. If I was to speak in Milwaukee, I would remind them that the Metropolitan Sewerage District in Milwaukee was basically created, or at least refurbished and enhanced by the WPA. The consequences of that generation's commitment to the promise of the Four Freedoms is evident. And it should be evident to us. All of which renders it all the more remarkable that we do not honor those men and women for their progressive struggles and achievements. How is it that the most celebrated generation in American history is not remembered for its most enduring accomplishment and greatest gift to the nation? The embedding of FDR's four freedoms in the very bedrock of American life. Now, I have no difficulty understanding why conservatives do not want to celebrate the four freedoms. And I want to make it clear that Ron Paul, not Rand, Ron Paul, in a recent book, basically said, I'm paraphrasing, that the four freedoms were one of the worst ideas ever concocted by an American president. Jim DeMint, former Republican senator from South Carolina, now the head of the Heritage Foundation, belittles freedom from want, once again saying, he lumps it next to something, you know, like communism as this ideal. That's all there. It's all in the writings. They know that most Americans still feel the impulse of the four freedoms. The bigger question isn't why would conservatives go out of their way to knock, to suppress, to deny the four freedoms. The better question we might ask is, why do liberals fail to address it? Why do liberals and the left ignore what they should be about? In 1997, the FDR Memorial was unveiled along the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C. And in 2004, the National World War II Memorial was opened on the National Mall. At the same time, millions of Americans snatched up books like Stephen Ambrose's Citizen Soldiers, Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation, James Bradley's Flags of Our Fathers. They went out to see Steven Spielberg Saving Private Ryan. They sat for hours watching programs like Ken Burns' PBS documentary The War, HBO's Band of Brothers, and The Pacific. By the way, I did all of these things. I loved them. Loved them. Still do. We turned out for events, both grand and intimate, all around the country, commemorating a generation's labors and sacrifices. Those memorials, those histories, those ceremonies beautifully honor those who prevailed against the Great Depression and the Axis powers. I am not denying. I think they are magnificent. We were talking at dinner this evening, and I said, when I go to Washington, the first thing I do on the Saturday morning is I walk the National Mall. I don't go up the Washington Monument anymore, but I go from the Washington Monument to the World War II, down to Lincoln, over to FDR, over to the Jefferson. I mean, I've loved the National Mall ever since I was 10 years old. And I think that we honor them in those memorials, The Greatest Generation, FDR, in these books. But there was something missing. There was something seriously missing. Even as we have proclaimed our eternal gratitude and promised never to forget all that they did, we have failed to remember what made the greatest generation and its greatest leader truly great. At serious cost to not only the memory and legacy of that generation, but also to our own shared prospects and possibilities, we have allowed the public telling of their lives and struggles to be drained of its most democratic, progressive, and inspiring content. Consider this. The greatest generation's leading tribunes, Ambrose, Brokaw, Spielberg, and Burns, whose works I think were magnificent, made absolutely no mention whatsoever of FDR's pronouncement of the four freedoms. It is inconceivable that they did not address the four freedoms. Go back and take a look. I'm sure many of you have those books. They utterly ignored how a president articulated the nation's promise anew in freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear, and how a generation went all out in their name not only to defend American democratic life, but also to enhance it. They utterly ignored how that president and those people saved the United States from economic destruction and political tyranny and proceeded to turn this nation into the strongest and richest in history. Once again, by harnessing the powers of democratic government and making America freer, more equal, and more democratic than ever before. Journalists, pundits, they all did the same. And even the saddest thing is, my colleagues on the left, the academic intellectuals on the left, actually belittled the greatest generation decade. the years of the boom, you might say, the greatest generation. A fellow I know who I believe teaches at one of the Hudson Valley colleges who wrote the book on the World War II Memorial said whenever he was asked, what are you working on now? He would say, I'm telling the story of the World War II Memorial. And they say, and people our age would say, why would you want to do that? Academic leftists belittled the celebration, the expressions of gratitude. They said, look, you know, it's all hype. They want to get us in the mood for a new war. Or they want us to buy this and that, you know, the books, the costumes, the frivolities. And I thought, they're missing the point here. They're missing the point. What they're failing to consider is the degree to which, when Americans turned out to thank a generation, they were not only turning out to thank that generation, they were basically yearning to recover the democratic spirit of that generation. And nobody seemed to realize it. As I made a note here, they constantly reminded us, my academic colleagues on the left, that the greatest generation phenomenon entailed lots of commercial and patriotic hype. They constantly reminded us that isolationism and racism tragically marked American attitudes and actions in the 30s and 40s. All true. But what they failed to consider is what that generation was truly about in spite of their own faults and failings, in spite of what they confronted, and how they endowed us with so much of their spirit. We didn't turn to the past in the 1990s because we wanted to escape the present or because we were fooled into doing so by commercial advertising, as so many left intellectuals asserted. In the midst of the most conservative era since the 1920s, we did so to recall and engage that past. We did what every generation confronting new challenges does. What are Americans about? We're not about blood. We're not even about the land as much as we talk about it. We are about a set of ideas, a set of documents, a set of principles about citizenship. And if we're going to ever figure out how it is that we're going to confront the crises of our day, then we have to look back. And that's what every generation that has, you know, that has that sensibility of being American has done. And that's what we were doing. I'll tell you a quick story. I won't go on much longer. We look back. We look back to those who, confronting mortal crises, made American life freer, more equal, and more democratic. That's what we were doing. Some of us did so in the clearest of terms. Responding to the spread of right-wing militias and the horrific 1995 attack on the Oklahoma City Federal Building, political activist Chip Berlay recalled his father's military service and post-war commitments to urge renewed respect for civil liberties, civil rights, and civil discourse. Berlay acknowledged that his father, a decorated veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, a lifelong Republican, and an ardent anti-communist, had his prejudices. But he noted how the same man refused to allow those attitudes to override the ideals for which he had fought. Berlay proudly recounted that his dad, while serving as a Little League coach in their suburban northern New Jersey town in the 1950s, and since I'm here in the Hudson Valley, I can tell you the town was Hillsdale, New Jersey, next door to where I grew up. His father was a Little League coach who recruited an interracial team and a Jewish assistant coach. And when acting as the Grand Marshal of the Memorial Day Parade in the early 70s, insisted on the right of peace marchers to join in the procession. And Berlay then recounted an exchange that he had had with his father not long before his father was to die of cancer. My dad, he recalled, was determined to put on that uniform one last time on Memorial Day. As I helped him dress, I asked him about the war. His only reply was to hand me one of his medals. And if you look at the book cover, it's that medal that adorns the front of the book and the back of the book. So his only reply to his son was to hand him one of his medals. Inscribed on the back were the words, "Freedom from fear and want, freedom of speech and religion, the four freedoms." As Berlay put it, my dad fought fascism to defend those freedoms, not just for himself, but for people of different religions and races, people he disagreed with, even people he was prejudiced against. That was a man. Today, the four freedoms are under attack. In part, he says, young Burleigh, because we forget why people fought World War II. I have another story which I'm going to leave out because I've been speaking long enough. Let me just close by saying this. When we look back at our greatest generations, and let's look especially at the generation that I've just worked on, the greatest generation, they came to know and they came to act upon something that we desperately need to do the same. They recognize, as I said before, that the only way to defend American democratic life is to enhance it. Or as Franklin Roosevelt said in 1930, we need to make America fairly radical for a generation. Thank you. Don't act like my 18-year-old students.
Do you think that the rapidly expanding technological age that we are living in and growing into is enhancing or impeding the very principles you're talking about?
I think your question is also an answer.
Okay.
Is also an answer in this respect. I think the technological revolutions and changes we've been witnessing, benefiting from and suffering, I think there's no question that they bring us closer to people we would not usually be close to, far, far away. I have this, my editor said, you know, you got to get on Twitter, Harvey told me a few years ago. He said, you got to get the message out long before this book comes out. So as Bob will tell you, I tweet away, okay? And it's kind of fun. So I end up in contact with people from all around the world, some of whom I probably would never like if we met in person. But nevertheless, we're brought together. On the other hand, and I don't know if this is the technological revolution, a number of radio people have asked me this. And can I shift the question slightly? People have said, what's the difference between the experiences of that generation that you've worked on, that you feel so strongly about, and our own generation, the generation that's now from their 20s to 50s and 60s, this moment in time? And I said, you know, the difference is this. We Americans today feel no less committed to freedom, equality, and democracy, despite the media portrayals of movements right and left. But the one thing that we don't have that that generation may never have wanted to have, but learned, and we ought to be smart enough to figure out how to do it without having to go to war like that, is they knew about unity and solidarity. They learned about it in the CCC. They learned about it in the WPA. They learned about it in the Marines. They learned about it in labor unions. They learned about it in so many ways. And that solidarity and unity in the face of conflict, crises, and dangers, that's where we're lacking. I look at my students and I think to myself, when we ended the draft, I know we still have selective service, when we ended the draft, we should have created national service. I believe that. You know, I joked with my students. I said, you folks need national service. First of all, because at least you'll have a job for a couple of years. But the second thing is that even if you go in and gripe about it, you'll be griping about it together. Now, you know, it sounds funny, but that, you know, that's what builds solidarity, this kind of shared bother. But on the other hand, what you'll see is that together, you can make a difference. You actually can transform not only your own life, but other people's lives. And I kind of wish that somehow or other, my generation, those of us who did not serve in Vietnam, my lottery number was so high, there would have been a nuclear war before I was called. I think we should have, even as we marched to end a war, we should have marched for national service. I think we've lost a great deal. I think young people yearn for that sense of solidarity and don't know where to find it. So thanks for the question. Let me also answer this thing that's been on my mind. Okay.
One of the reasons
I brought it up. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but on NPR I heard a very interesting discussion about the demise of free press in the United States, and a large part was in a large reason was in, due to, he was claiming, the technological revolution and the the word's not coming to me.
The amount of money required to sustain
that kind
of activity.
And he went into the history of the free press and how much money from the founders' day forward to the present day, how much money the federal government put into support, which I never realized. He said the equivalent back in the founders' day that they put into support of free press because they understood how important it was, would be in the billions of dollars today, in the equivalent amount.
Right.
And then he likened it to saying that that demise in free press and the buildup of the militaristic state of mind really is turning this country into a true definition of a fascist state.
Yeah, I could never buy an argument like that. Now that I would say this is interesting. A couple of things you said that I want to respond to. First of all, if you look closely at American economic history, every era of tremendous and rapid economic growth was usually instigated, bolstered, and made possible by public investments. Everyone. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't because we had some phenomenal innovators. We still do. And the last thing you'd want to do is stymie innovation. But it's also the case that every economic advance that we've had has usually been a consequence of public investments. Okay, then there was another thing you said, the fascist thing I would never like. The idea of, let me go back now to your original question and connect it to your free press idea. There is no doubt that the media is concentrated. I mean, concentrated and driven more so than ever by a bottom line. I mean, I know people who had local radio shows all across the country, and in the last 5 years are off. I think the term is pay to play. However, one thing that I find fascinating, and I have yet to really embrace it fully as an idea, because usually at the beginning it's sloppy, messy, dull, boring, whatever else, but podcast radio. And all, we have found in the same technologies that seem to undo that public debate, we have found ways of creating new means, new venues for public discussion. Of course, what happens is, just as the independent bookstore was swamped by the big box bookstore, and Amazon swamped, I mean, remember Borders? Okay. Well, similarly, Amazon may well find its own demise someday in some other variation on a theme. And so in the same way that we look around and we see this vast concentration of corporate media power, it's also the case that at the grassroots, there's a lot of media going on. I mean, I'm not a techie, so I can't get too deeply embedded, but I have gotten so many calls to do interviews with somebody has a podcast radio show with the Tavis Smiley Network calls me. I was called by someone who's a Wiccan, you know, a Wiccan, and does sort of sex therapy. And I said, why would you call me? She said, oh, I like your tweets, you know. You know, and I felt funny at first. My wife is here. I thought, am I going to go on a radio show that talk about sex? I mean, I love talking about sex, but I don't want to do it on the radio, okay? So thanks for the second question, too. Anybody else want to?
Harvey, this may be a little bit out of the scope of your book, but to what extent has the world not forgotten the four freedoms, whereas we have forgotten?
Well, I left out some elements in my talk because I realized I was going on longer than I should. What I think is this. I think we have not forgotten the four freedoms, but we've forgotten how to get them. We know the four freedoms. They're deeply embedded. That's my whole point. This generation literally endowed us, imbued us. I mean, but we don't know how to get there. We forget the degree to which they formed these movements, these organizations, and they had a president. And I think this is the topic of another talk. Maybe I'll give it this summer. They had a president who knew American history, who believed in America's democratic purpose and promise. This was FDR, and who had incredible confidence in his fellow citizens. And we have not seen a president like that since FDR. You and I were talking before about who would be the fourth greatest president. Well, whoever that would be, the one thing we know is not since FDR, and before that probably not since Lincoln, and before that not since Washington, did we have that kind of figure. Now, we don't want to have to just depend on a leader. But it's also the case that Roosevelt had this confidence in his fellow citizens to engage them. Now, that generation imbues those four freedoms in us, undeniably. The four freedoms are inscribed on the wall at the FDR Memorial down in D.C. You and I both served on the committee to advise the park, and we know the four freedoms are there. But if they're just going to be on the wall, yeah, we remember them. But we need to remember how to make them possible. And one of the things to understand, of course, is that they are never finite. I think that's the key of American history. We create, we advance, and then we realize we're not there yet. So I think the question is, can we remember? And I was saying to most people, Bill Moyer said to me today, he says, Harvey, you start off with this, we need to remember, we need to remember. Are you really trying to rally people to remember an act? I said, absolutely. But we can't act until we remember. You have to help me, and I'm not going to put you on the spot if you don't remember, but you know the words. When Roosevelt dedicated the library, June 41, was it? Yeah, not bad. I was close, right, June? He gave those, there was that line about a nation and history. A nation... And something about to have the confidence to act upon what they've learned. Okay? And that's what I do. I'm a historian. And I think it is a it's been a long 20-year tragedy that we are remembering the greatest leader and the greatest generation of the 20th century, if not all of American history, and failing to remember what truly made them great. Yeah.
Harvey, I want to say something about remembering the four freedoms, and perhaps what I was going to say is going to sound a little bit pompous. I don't mean it in the sense of being self-serving. Two decades ago, there was a big computer company here in the Hudson Valley that laid off 20,000 people between Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Fishkill. Now, I actually created the first economic development forums to start this community on the rebuild. I also, and I thought what you said about the four freedoms, freedom from fear and freedom from want, I also went on and I created this thing called the Dutchess Alliance for Human Needs. And it was a mobilization of all of the human service agencies in the community had lost a third of their funding, had fired staff at the very time that we needed it more than ever. And I went out to them and I saw this, because I spent 40 years in the insurance business, and I saw this as a risk management problem, potential for loss. And what cripples a community but fear and anxiety? The inability to care for yourself. And I created this thing called the Dutchess Alliance for Human Needs. I mobilized 110 agencies to work in unison. I said, you can cast out your line as one, or we can weave a net for the community.
Yeah.
And I ran that for 4 years, seven major events. The biggest one was inviting 3,200 unemployed people for a day of services called Practical Solutions for the Unemployed. And Business Week couldn't understand how we went from the lowest unemployment to the highest unemployment to the lowest unemployment in 24 months.
It's impressive.
But that's where this whole idea, and I think it has to come from the language, we have to watch the language so that we build the unity. The very first principle that I had, there were eight of them, and I only remember the very first one, was everybody who participated, if you wanted to play in my sandbox, you had to leave your own agenda at the door and remember why we were there. And when you and I spoke the other day, we have the same objectives. We perhaps see different pathways. And so my question is, and as you travel around talking about this, is how do we reconcile the language to solve the problems?
I don't think we can reconcile language. I think it's a question of whether or not our small d, democratic leaders, are able, have the capacity that FDR did, and as my very first hero, Thomas Paine, did, to put into words what most Americans are thinking and feeling and probably aspiring to, but are themselves not articulate in that fashion. So, for example, if I had the talent, I'd want to know not to reconcile language, but to harness a language that would transcend the divides. And I think, for example, and that's what Roosevelt did. I mean, really astonishingly so. You know, the Four Freedoms, when Americans heard them, you know, most Americans didn't believe they were going to actually spread the Four Freedoms globally. But they had no doubt, all the opinion polls showed, they had no doubt that they were going to do it here. They wanted to do it here. And they had their own variations on that theme. I mean, African Americans in the South saw Roosevelt speaking to them to end freedom from fear. You can imagine, right? Jewish Americans up north, predominantly, believed that that freedom of worship didn't just mean the right to pray as they wished, because they had that. What it meant is that all Americans, regardless whether they were Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, or, as time would tell, as we enlarged our diversity, Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, that they would stand equally alongside of anyone else and not be discriminated against. I mean, so the words themselves didn't need reconciliation. I don't want to fall back on the man on the white horse, but Roosevelt was one of those leaders who really could find a way to enable Americans, even as they might beat the crap out of each other in a bar fight, to somehow transcend those divides. And, you know, it's funny, this is a personal note. My first hero when I was a child was Thomas Paine. And I came to this work in particular because I felt I owed it to my father and his generation. My father was a combat veteran of the Battle of the Bulge and a Purple Heart veteran. And that he, somehow his generation was being ill-served by the way in which we were trying to remember. We needed to remember more. But the other thing was that Franklin Roosevelt spoke of Thomas Paine, I discovered. February 23rd, 1942, Washington's birthday weekend. Americans were getting the hell knocked out of them in East Asia and the Pacific, and they weren't even into Europe yet. And his advisor said, you know, we're going to have to do something. So Roosevelt went on the radio, fireside chat. Some people think it was his finest fireside chat. And he tells the story, he opens up with telling the story of Washington's retreat. Not, you know, we're all here. Washington's retreat from New York across the Hudson to Fort Lee. And then the retreat across New Jersey. And how along the way, and then he shifts to MacArthur's troops in the Pacific, to the men who are getting ready to go over to North Africa. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. And he tells Americans, this is a global war. We're going to win. Okay. And then he closes and he quotes Thomas Paine from the Crisis Paper. You know, the famous lines, these are the times that try men's souls. And he quotes it in full and he says at the end, Thomas Paine spoke for Americans then, and those are the words that speak for us today. And I said, this is my man. And so as I tell people, my two favorite figures in American history, Thomas Paine and Franklin Roosevelt. Not because they happened to bump into each other in the books, but because they had this capacity to speak in such a way as to enable people to transcend those divides. And it just so happens, Thomas Paine was born on January 29th, Roosevelt was born on January 30th. Kismet, right? Fate. Sorry, I took away from the question, but I needed to get that out.
It's not a question as much of a statement. FDR had a wife who also exemplified his wishes by traveling the United States at great risk to herself to raise the awareness of African Americans, the plight
Absolutely.
Of them. And I think that his greatness, and it doesn't diminish, but he joined with her under really tenuous situation in which she became as great as he in some ways by demonstrating things that we have not seen since in any of the other first ladies. And I'm not faulting them.
I know what you're saying. I can tell you in my book, I didn't do it here because this was most of all about the generation and the president. But in my book, one of the things that I came on, and I thought this was fabulous. Before Roosevelt spoke of the four freedoms, Eleanor was giving speeches on the four equalities. And I always wondered to what extent Eleanor, I know that they didn't share a bedroom, but I always wondered to what extent she was telling him over meals or other things, four equalities. Keep that in mind. Don't lose sight. You know, so that was the other thing. The other thing is, I've got a whole bunch of things in my head about Eleanor. I was telling Bob earlier this evening that I'm fascinated by the fact that Franklin quoted Thomas Paine, because I forgot to say, not since Thomas Jefferson had a president until Franklin Roosevelt quoted Thomas Paine and used his name in a speech. That kind of divide. Now, I always ask, and I've said to Bob, can you let me in after hours? I got to find out someday. Where did Roosevelt get his interest in Thomas Paine? And then I discovered a book by Eleanor Roosevelt, The Moral Basis of Democracy. Little book. Great little book. And in there, she's got 5 pages on Thomas Paine. More pages on Thomas Paine than any other American figure. So who knows? Maybe even in those ways that make me all the more affectionate for FDR, it was Eleanor sort of feeding that. But I also then want to tell you, having said that, and I don't want you, because I don't want you to think I'm just going to patronize you and tell you you're absolutely right, I think Franklin Roosevelt would have been great anyhow. But I think Eleanor made sure that he was great. And I, in fact, let me go a step further. I think let me use the we sense as in we Americans. I think my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation made Franklin Roosevelt great. And that's exactly what he wanted. And I have said for several years, I've been very disappointed with the current administration, and I've said for several years, we failed to make him great. Because he would never, ever have refused to do the things that needed doing if we had pushed him to act. At least I hope that that would be the case. But to go back to Roosevelt, presidents have qualities. We make them great or not. Okay?
And I think that's a great way to end the program. So thank you, Harvey.
Thanks.
And if you'll give us just a couple of minutes to get out to the bookstore, Harvey will be there to sign your books. Thank you all very much for coming, and we'll see you at the next program.